Test. So, if I am correct, we did finish the skull and facial bones last week, correct? Okay, so as I said, when I teach the material, I teach bones first, then I teach joints, and then I teach the muscles so that we get a sense of where what's working and where things work in relationship to the joint. So we kind of did the one set of joints in the skull, which were the sutures, right? So they're done. The only other joint that we have to deal with when we relate to the face and the skull is the joint that represents your mouth and being able to chew and that kind of stuff, right? The opening and closing of your mouth. This is known as the temporomandibular joint, which tells you what two structures are articulating. Bone and the mandible, okay? I've sort of mentioned a couple of times, seems that some of you wear night guards here. This tends to be a joint that's a lot of people, they clench and grind their teeth, those sorts of things. It's this joint that gets affected. So we can see that it's here. If we remember, when we were talking about the mandible, we had two processes of the mandible. The posterior was the congular process, and this was the articular part. And what was this? The coronoid process, which is for muscle attachments, those sorts of things. So we're talking about then, it is the articulation of that coronoid process of the mandible in relationship to part of the temporal bone, which gives us this joint that we're working with, or we're going to talk about. So it is considered to be a modified hinge because it can do a couple of other movements. All right, now I want you to consider that when we look at this joint, okay, and we can consider the two articular condyles, right, we know that it opens and closes. Opening, by the way, is called, when we're dealing with the temporomandibular joint, opening is depression, because the mandible is traveling inferiorly, and closing is elevation. Okay? So that's its hinge parts. But because of the way that it articulates, it can also go side to side, and it can retract and protract. Okay? They're minor, they're small movements, but we are able to do it. Have you ever seen a cow chew? Right? They go up, but they also go significantly side to side, right? We do a little bit, but that's not part of our chewing pattern generally, just a little bit, but we don't need a lot of it. So it depresses, opening mouth, elevates, closing mouth, protrusion, which is the protraction of the mental area or the chin, retrusion, which is the retraction of the chin, and then lateral movement side to side. So we have to consider that we have a very kind of oddly shaped joint. We have the mandibular fossa of the temporal bone. So when I draw that, it kind of looks like this. So this would be the external auditory meatus, okay? And of course, then we'd have sort of this part being up here would sort of be the zygomatic bone, kind of anteriorly. But we're talking right in this area here, okay? So we say that the mandibular fossa of the temporal bone is concave, and that the articular tubercle of the mandible is convex, which of course we can see here in the model. So therefore, like so. Looks pretty congruent, doesn't it? All right, you have a concavity, you have a convexity. All right, now we're going to learn something that this joint does, and we actually do have a disc in here. Oops, kind of doing it backwards here a little bit, but that's okay, you'll get the gist of it. And this disc sort of fits in between the two, and it is a meniscus, the same as what you find in the knee. It just happens to be in the joint. And I think I mentioned last week, if you have temporomandibular joint problems and you've got clicking on opening and closing, it's because the disc is kind of getting away and the mandible is kind of either clicking onto the disc or clicking off of the disc. We'll get to that in a bit. So we can see here we've got this zygomatic process here of the temporal bone. Here's the external auditory meatus, and we can see this concavity here with this convexity of the mandible at the congular part of it here, and we can see the disc inside there cut in the place. So the mandibular, we have to remember, the mandibular fossa is bordered by the articular tubercle anteriorly and the postglenoid process posteriorly. Where the heck are those? Okay, so this is the articular tubercle. Okay, and then we have what's called the postglenoid process. Right here is the postglenoid process. So it's kind of bordered by these two areas. Posterior to the postglenoid process is the internal auditory meatus. So you can see that sort of as the bone sits. So if you didn't bring your skulls, did you? Okay. So you can see it here. You can see here is the meatus here, right? And we can see that they put a disc in here on this particular one. And that's where the kind of the concavity is. So we're saying that this postglenoid process is anterior to the meatus for the ear. So it's kind of sitting in front of it, okay? Now there's a fibrous capsule here. It is a synovial joint. So there's a fibrous capsule attached to the margins of the articular area of the temporal bone and around the neck of the mandible. So when we look at the neck, if we remember where the neck was, right, we had the condylar eminence here at the top, which is the articular part, and then we have a narrowing just below it, which represents the neck. So we're saying that the fibrous capsule surrounds the neck and covers over, right, we're saying attaches the margins of the articular area of the temporal bone. So in other words, this fibrous capsule, where if we were to draw it, would sort of, actually, no, I shouldn't do it this way. I would be mistaken if I did that. Okay. Sort of covering this whole area that represents the joint. And this capsule, of course, is relatively loose fitting. And as we've learned in the past, it, you know, the fact that it's loose fitting means it allows a lot of range of motion of this joint to occur. And in a moment, you're going to discover just what this joint actually can do for movement. So we can see here, here is the postglenoid tubercle here, and here is the external auditory meatus, and then we can see this concavity here, which is part of the zygomatic process of the temporal bone. We can see the backside of it here, so this is looking sort of inside this way at the joint, and you can see how the capsule covers the majority of the superior part of the joint, and of course wraps around quite tightly around the neck, which is just inferior to the head of the condylar process. Now, when we look at the fact that we have this meniscus, there are two synovial membranes which line the fibrous capsule. So the disc divides, if I were to make it just a wee bit larger here, we've got the disc that kind of goes like this, and then we've got the temporal bone sort of here, and then we have the mandible here. The disc divides the joint into two spaces. So we have the superior synovial membrane, which lines the fibrous capsule superior to the disc, which we will make in red. So this would be the superior. And then we have an inferior synovial membrane that lines the fibrous capsule inferior to the disc, which is here. All right? Remembering that the synovial membrane is responsible for creating synovial fluid. Correct. So that means that when we look at the articulation, we have to consider that when we look at it sort of from this perspective, we will have movement of the disc on the temporal bone, and we will have movement of the condylar head on the disc. Everybody follow me so far? So the disc is going to move on that temporal bone, superior part, and the inferior part of the disc is going to articulate with the condylar head of the mandible. Yes? Make sense? Okay, so you have one synovial space and another synovial space. One superior, one inferior. So we can see here, here's the condyle in this drawing. Here is the disc. We can see here in this sort of speckled color here. And we can see that we have a synovial superior joint space here and an inferior joint space here. Of course, these little lines here with the straight lines represent the articular cartilage of the tips of the bones themselves, right? So, of course, being a joint, it does have articular cartilage and a synovial membrane, synovial fluid, and so forth, yeah. There's still potential spaces, but we say there's still a space because there is still a minor bit of fluid in there between the two of them, okay? We do have a ligament here, inferior posteriorly. So this is the post-glenoid tubercle here we can see. Here is the meatus, the internal acoustic meatus, and we can see where there's the ligament here that kind of helps hold the disc a little bit into place, all right? We'll talk a little bit more about that. So we can say then that the disc divides the joint into two separate joint spaces. And this is important to understand because this is going to come back again and again, especially in your assessments class. Protrusion and retrusion. So what would that be? No, but what movements would that be? Sticking your chin out, pulling your chin back. Okay? That is also known as translation, and that occurs at the superior compartment. So protrusion, retrusion occurs here. Elevation and depression occur at the inferior compartment. All right? So let's take a moment, partner up. You gonna put your pens down? Okay, partner up. Somebody's a therapist. Come on, Kenny, because you've got an odd number here. Okay, you can partner up over there. Partners. Okay, so what I would like you to do first and foremost, it's going to sound kind of unusual, is therapist. I would like you to stick your finger in your client's ear holes. Yep. Come on. Put your fingers in their ear holes. Shut, not. No. You're not going all the way in. Just in a bit. Just so that you're in there. Okay. Both fingers. Not through her hair. Come on. Yeah. Like, come here. Come here. Come here. No, so just like that. Okay?
I hear nothing.
Okay, it's like that. Okay, so just put them just inside the ear.
Like to each other?
No, just one. So one therapist, one patient for now. Okay? All right. No, in her ears. Come on. You're going to be touching weirder parts than this, let me tell you, as you go through. Come on. Good. Okay, no, but leave them in there. Put the fingers in and leave them in there. One in each hole. Okay, like that. Okay, ask your patient to slowly open their mouth as wide as they can and then close their mouth and do it a couple of times. Okay? Okay, what do you feel? Open wide and close. What happens? No. Okay, so now I'm going to tell you what happened. I want you to go back to put your fingers in there and feel the motion. Okay, we said, hang on a second. We said that the inferior compartment is responsible for elevation and depression. So, hang on a sec. So that means this spins. All right? Initially, when you open your mouth, the congular process of the mandible spins. But when you get them to open their mouth wide, you have protrusion. So what I want you to feel is as they open their mouth, you will first feel spin, and then you will feel the congular process slide anteriorly. Go for it. On them. Is anybody feeling clicks and pops? Anybody feeling clicks? And then you're going to switch. Yep. 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 Yeah, okay. It's either popping onto or off of the meniscus. So we're going to learn here in a moment that when the muscle that opens your mouth contracts, it has fibers attached to the disc. And it therefore, as that translation, that protraction occurs, the muscle contraction also pulls the disc anteriorly along with it so that it fits, okay? If that muscle is chronically tight, the disc is anterior, and as you open, that congular part of the mandible pops onto the disc because it's already ahead of the game. Okay? All right. Yes. Yeah, we're going to do it a different way. Okay. So now, we're not going to be quite so intimate. I would like you to palpate just anterior to the external auditory meatus, just anterior to it, and get not on yourself. God. Okay. So just on the outside, just anterior to the external auditory meatus, and again, have them slowly open and close, feel the spin initially, and then the anterior translation or protraction of the congular head of the mandible. Really moves forward, doesn't it? Do you click? Okay. Now you feel it, don't you? Okay. How many people here had a clicker? It sounds like The Last of Us. Anybody here Last of Us fans? Absolutely. I played the game for like forever. Okay. How many people here have a clicker? Okay. All right. So, what I'd like you to do, just for fun, okay, ask them to open and close their mouth here in a moment, and I just want you to observe, does that chin go straight up and down, or does it do a little wonky kind of thing on its way up or down? Do it slowly, open and close slowly. Just a bit faster so it's more natural. You see it now, don't you? Yeah. Okay, who's got the wobbly jaw? Yeah. All right. Why is that happening? So, we said it's a modified hinge, right? Which means open and close, but we have to consider this translation that's occurring on that wide opening. So because we have a right and left side, right, we need balance between the two when the mouth opens and closes. If, because of clenching, muscles are tight on one area, one side's going to move odd compared to the other. And so you're going to see that stronger, tight, short muscle is going to pull on that jaw as it opens initially and then come back again. When you do assessments, it's a really cool tool. If you really want to see how much movement, you take a toothpick, you put it between the front teeth at the top and the bottom so you have sort of a landmark you can kind of watch, and then have them open and close, and you'll see that bottom toothpick will do some S's or some C's or all sorts of things, right? Okay. Now, I can tell you that this is one of my pet things when I was a massage therapist. I love working on TMJ. I had a lot of good results with it. I once had a, I think I told you guys this before, right? I once had a lady who hadn't been able to fully open her mouth for 15 years. And once I got into these structures, she started crying because she could actually open her mouth. If you want to see, here's the test for it. These three fingers, up and down like this, you should be able to open your mouth and put all three fingers in. If you can't, you've got something that's obstructing or affecting your ability to fully open your mouth. You can't get it in, can you? Yeah. See? I bet you. Yeah, can't get it in? Yeah. So, remember that when we get to the muscles, okay? All right. Come on back. I know it's fun, but come on back. Okay. So you must remember, this is why I told you this. So you now know that for normal movement to occur in depression and elevation, you need both translation and spin. So if your patient comes to you today and they can open their mouth only this far, which is just spin, and they can't open wide, guess what? Something's going on that's affecting the superior compartment of the joint. And when you start learning the muscle attachments, it will give you a sense of what muscle is likely the problem. So this is why, I'm recording here, but this is why you need to know this shit. Because this is where it's going to start to come. Because, you know, someone comes to you with, you know, headaches because they've got this tight TMJ and you're trying to fix them. During your assessment, depending on what they can or can't do, you're going to be a great student who studied hard. And remember, protrusion retrusion is superiorly, and spin for elevation depression is posteriorly. It starts building an assessment picture for you to help your patient to get a better understanding of what structures aren't functioning properly. Okay? Now, the articular capsule thickens laterally to form the lateral ligament that becomes this. So on the lateral aspect of the joint, the capsule gets very, very thick. And so therefore, because it contributes or it shares fibers with the fibrous capsule, it's considered an intrinsic ligament. The lateral ligament, along with the post-glenoid tubercle, okay, prevent posterior dislocation. I can punch you in the jaw from the front, and you're likely not going to dislocate. But if I punch you laterally, there's a good chance that you're going to pop out, right? If you're hit properly. So by this is like, that's why you can protrude much farther than you can retract, because this is bumping up to the post-glenoid tubercle and it can't go much further because it actually stops it, okay? It's actually, let's do it here on this one. Oh, it's got a disc too. Ah, that hasn't. That area right there. Okay. So there's where the condylar head of the mandible would sit. This whole structure right here posteriorly. So anterior to the meatus, but posterior to this concavity, this is the post-glenoid tubercle right here. Okay? Okay, makes sense, kind of, sort of. Okay. Where did I put my clicker? Oh, here we go. Okay. So here we go, a little bit simpler picture. Here's the post-glenoid tubercle back here on the left. Here is the condylar process of the mandible. Here is the temporal bone, eventually becoming the zygomatic process as it moves out. Now, the artist, again, has drawn big, thick spaces, synovial spaces, but the reality is they're potential. So we can see them in dark here. So we've got superior joint here, inferior joint here, and we can see that, you know, we've got the disc in between. Okay? All right. So when we're looking at TMJ problems, this is the normal. So we can see here the articulation between the mandible and the temporal bone and the disc is nicely lined up. Here again is the ligament that kind of holds things in place. And you'll see there's a muscle here. It kind of attaches a bit on the disc anteriorly there. Can you see that? right? So right here, some of these fibers of the muscle actually attach to the disc as well. Now, normally what happens is this muscle and other muscles will go to full mouth opening or depression under normal circumstances when that muscle contracts along with the other muscles to depress the jaw. It pulls the disc anteriorly. So we have a bit of a problem here. If I come over to this side, because you're probably asking yourselves, Ryan, why is there a disc? Looks like it fits pretty good. There's a problem. Okay. I'm not going to put the disc in for now. So this is kind of the normal setup with mouth kind of semi-closed, just relaxed, right? So we know on initial opening, the condyle spins. But as we go into full opening, the condyle ends up here, correct? Because it slides anteriorly. Well, we have a problem. We have a convexity on a convexity, don't we? That's not very congruent, is it? So that's why the meniscus is here. When you go into full opening, the muscle, one of the muscles that helps with full opening, as I said, is anteriorly attached. Some of its fibers is anteriorly attached to the disc. So when that muscle is contracting to open, it's pulling the disc from here to here. So we have a disc that kind of looks like that. So it fits the convexity on its superior surface of the temporal bone, and it fits the convexity of the condylar head of the mandible in full opening. Does everybody understand that? So that disc gets pulled along with the bone, so you get a really nice congruent joint here. Otherwise, you have a convexity on a convexity, and that's not going to be a very powerful joint, is it? All right? Now, if you've got a super tight muscle, what can happen? So when the joint is not functioning properly, the disc is commonly pulled forward when the jaw is in use, causing the bones of the skull and jaw to grind together. So if that muscle that normally pulls the disc anteriorly is overused and tight, it's already setting the disc up anteriorly, and upon opening, the disc gets all jammed up anteriorly into here. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Okay, everybody follow me? You can't witch? Oh, I can. So you guys know that we work intraorally? So I put a glove on, go in your mouth, and I go right into that muscle that's pulling that disc, and I find trigger points in there, and then calm it down, the disc slides back into place, and you're good to go. You won't like me very much. It doesn't feel very good, but it really does the trick. It's interesting. You know, if you guys heard the term yet, issues in the tissues? Kind of heard that yet? We carry a lot of things. Some of you are going to have a cry in class when you're doing treatments. You're not going to know why. It happens quite often. Something in your life you're holding in your tissues, and one of your partners will start working on an area, and you'll just start bawling. And you'll be like, what's happening to me? It's because you're holding something in the tissue. I've had clients cry. I've had them uncontrollably laugh. And it's all part and parcel of where we're at. So what happens when, the question is, why do we have TMJ problems? So many TMJ problems in our society right now. Why does everybody clench and grind? Pardon? Stress. Okay. One of the theories is like a dog. What happens when you corner an animal or a dog? They clench and go, right? Well, one of the theories is because we're so stressed out all the time, when we're sleeping, we go, because we're stressed out. So what happens is because you're clenching all the time, that muscle gets really tight and short, and then you got a problem. So when I stick my finger in there and relax it, whatever that stress is that's causing it, quite often comes out. Yes. Helps it a whole bunch, yes. Yes. It prevents the teeth, and it actually tractions the jaw a little bit. So it takes the two bones and just gently pulls them apart a little bit, so that disc has room to move and it's less likely to be a problem. But it's not the full answer. I wanted to do a bit of research a few years ago, because when they put a disc in, They just take a mold and make a guard and put it in, right? I wanted to actually work on the muscle, set the jaw a little bit better, and then make the guard and see if that made a difference. Yeah, it does, right? A little bit. So that's what's going on. Having a hell of a time with my clicker today. Oh, there it is. Okay, so just think about those things. So this disc needs to be in place. You are going to be learning this treatment probably in about semester 4-ish or so, somewhere in there. Yeah, lockjaw can be part of it. So how many people here have been to a dentist, had your mouth open for an extended period of time, you can't close it? That's TMJ. That's the disc in TMJ. Your mouth's been open for so long that the articular disc of the meniscus gets stuck between the two bones, and it can't happen. No, I can fix it. It's real simple. I just take my two fingers, I put them in your teeth and jaw, like that, and I pull down and forward. And it'll slide right out for you. So I can tell you, if for those who have TMJ problems, a really good exercise is when you're lying in bed at night, when you calm down, relax those muscles, you take your two of your thumbs and your two index fingers, you hook around your lower teeth, and when you're relaxed, you just gently pull down on the jaw, thinking of taking this part of the jaw and just gently pull it, trying to pull it down and give yourself a bit of relief. So it's literally just, and some of you might actually feel really good when you do it. Or you have a bit of discomfort when you do it. Oh no, it feels really good. It feels very good, trust me. It feels very, very good. And then if you're adventurous, pull down and forward. And you may not initially be able to do it because that muscle is so tight and strong, it just won't go. So just pull down. So get the thumbs underneath. Hook in. Feels really good. Does it feel good? If I had gloves, I'd show you, but one of them. Lateral. Yep. So the other thing is, I'm not going to hurt you. The other thing is, so open just a little bit. Go right in there. Oh, that's the muscle that's pulling. So just do that for yourself as well. Simple as that. Yeah. Oh, trigger points galore in this thing, man. Yeah. It's a bit of an endemic in our society is TMJ problems. Okay, so it's a synovial joint. So we've talked about a fibrous capsule. We've talked about a meniscus. We've talked about separate joint cavities. We've talked about fibrous capsule, synovial membrane, and so forth. So, of course, because of the synovial joint, it has ligaments. Now, because we talked about the lateral ligament being intrinsic, meaning it shared fibers with the fibrous capsule, we have two extrinsics. So, the first is called the stylomandibular ligament. Right off the bat, what's that tell you? It attaches from what to what? From the stylet process to the mandible. Ligaments always tell you exactly where they are. So when studying ligaments, its name, no matter where in the body, it always tells you exactly where it is. Well, to a degree, right? So the stylomandibular ligament helps connect the mandible to the cranium. It's not significant in strengthening to the joint, but it does. You have to think, you know, this kind of hangs a little bit, right? This mandible, so it kind of keeps it in there. The more important one, though, is the sphenomandibular ligament. So that tells you that runs from the bone to the... Right. It arises from the spine of the sphenoid to the mandible. It is the primary passive support of said manual, and it serves as a swinging hinge. So here is your stylomandibular here coming. That's why the styloid process is so long and stylus in nature, is because the ligament attaches and comes down almost to the angle of the mandible back here. And then the sphenomandibular, you can see how that works as sort of the fulcrum for the hinge, yes? So we can see that there's a bit of the spin that's going to occur initially in opening, but as that travels anteriorly in that protraction or in that translation, you can see, you can see how it would kind of hang and spin around that ligament, yes? And kind of spin around because of where it's hanging, right? So it does play a big role in maintaining that appropriate relationship between the you know, the mandible, part of that temporal bone, and then the disc itself. Okay. I don't know what I did there. Okay, so the articular disc is said to be concaval convex on the superior portion, and the inferior surface is concave. So what it's saying is, it kind of looks like this. So the backside of the disc here. It kind of looks like that. So if we look over here, so the configuration I have here, right? So we look at that picture to the left, that disc would nicely fit right in here, doesn't it? Right? It's a bit convex, so it fits up into this temporal bone here. And of course, the underside is concave because the mandibular process of the mandible is convex. When this slides forward, it has to fit into here. So it has to be concave to fit into this area of the temporal bone, but of course it still remains concave on the inferior surface because the convexity of the mandible doesn't change. Does that make sense to everybody? So as it slides forward, it's just allowing it to fit better into the temporal bone as it slides forward, as the meniscus slides forward. So we say then, as the mouth opens, the condylar process of the mandible moves anteriorly, placing the convex process of the mandible in contact with the convex articular eminence of the temporal bone, hence the reason for its shape. It must be remembered that at no time do the condyle of the mandible nor the articular eminence of the temporal bone make contact with each other, okay? So they don't really attach. Now, if I look at my mother has terrible temporal mandibular joint problems to the point that she actually ground her meniscus away by the time she was 60. Hence the reason, again, why you wear a night guard. Because every time you hear a crunch and a click, just think of a little shaving of that meniscus comes off, never to be replaced again, okay? So my mother had it really bad to the point she lost the disc, and she had what's called a dry socket. So her synovial membrane wasn't even producing fluid anymore. So she used to open and close her mouth, and it sounded like the hinge on a rusty hinge on a door. You'd literally hear it go, She did have some invasive surgery, but most dentists will tell you that TMJ surgery really doesn't work very well. I even had a physician I used to massage all the time. And Robbie would talk like this because his jaw was so bad he lost it. Both his TMJ menisci were gone. So when he talked, his jaw would just kind of go all over the place. He couldn't control it very well because he had ruined his discs. So, oh, yeah, very. Lots of headaches. And just remember, when we look here, discs don't have any nerves, right? So you don't feel anything as long as the disc is in place. Even the articular cartilage that are on these bony structures, again, is aneural. You don't feel anything. But the moment you grind it away and you have what's called subchondral meaning cartilage, so bone that lies just under cartilage, if that gets exposed, the other bone that the cartilage is gone, it really friggin' hurts. Whether it's knee, shoulder, elbow, jaw, it doesn't make any difference. Well, there's no periosteum under the cartilage, but because you've got exposed bone, you do have nerve endings there and you feel the pain. Yes. Yeah. Okay. The outer surfaces of the disc, you know, we've got to think of this three-dimensionally. The outer surfaces of the disc actually attach to the capsule and is kept in place. So this is a lovely picture. I like this one. Here's your post-glenoid tubercle that we can see here. You do have, ligamentous attachments of the posterior disc into the post-glenoid tubercle. The disc here is sitting nice and normal. Here's the mandibular condyle. Now, this is a muscle called lateral pterygoid, which we'll be talking about. But you can see how part of its fibers do actually attach onto that anterior part of the disc so that the disc does come forward in protraction when you're opening your mouth quite widely or depressing your mandible to the extreme. Imagine the configuration a snake has with this joint. Because snakes actually dislocate their jaws to eat the food that they do, and then it'll bring their jaw back into place again. And you can see there's all kinds of configurations here of disc placement that can cause lots of problems for clicking. You can have a look at the discs just for information's sake. And as I said, in semester 4 or so, I think you are doing a TMJ treatment. You'll start to learn it. So There must be muscles related to this. This joint moves. Goes up, it goes down, it goes, you know, elevation, depression, protraction, retraction, lateral movements. So there's got to be muscles that affect all these. And there are. We have what are called lesser muscles of mastication. And these are muscles up in, have you guys palpated the hyoid bone up here yet? And you kind of will for, you know, at some point in the next couple of weeks. So you have a bone here called the hyoid bone. Any muscles above that are called suprahyoids. Any muscles below that are called infrahyoids. Hence the reason for the names here. Now, I'm not going to be examining you on these next week. They're just there to be listed because we are actually going to go into these a little more in depth. So don't worry, these we won't necessarily be on the quiz for next week, okay? I promise, actually. Yeah. Oh, trust me, I got lots of stuff already, right? So when we look here at the side of the skull, we can see we have a large area here. This is known as the temporal fossa. So when discussing muscles related to the temporal mandibular joint, we have to look at the temporal fossa. It is boundaried by posteriorly and superiorly by the temporal lines, which are here. It is anteriorly by the frontal and zygomatic bones. So here's the frontal bone and the zygomatic bone here. So this is the anterior part of it. We've got lateral is the zygomatic arch. Remember how the zygomatic arch kind of came out, right? Took the coronoid process there. And then inferiorly by the infratemporal crest, which is just inferomedially to the zygomatic arch. And here's the zygomatic arch right here. So this, whenever you hear the temporal fossa, right, if I say to you this muscle attaches within the temporal fossa at the inferior temporal line, I'm talking about the muscle being in this boundary right here. Okay? There is an infratemporal fossa. It's a bit more irregularly shaped. It's deep and inferior to the zygomatic arch. So think of, if you feel your own cheek or your zygomatic arch, above is the temporal fossa and below is the infratemporal fossa. So you think of that line of your cheekbone, temporal fossa, infratemporal fossa. Okay? So its boundaries are the ramus of the mandible laterally, medial is the lateral pterygoid plate of the sphenoid, anteriorly is the posterior aspects of the maxilla. Anterior is the posterior aspect of the maxilla. Yeah, posterior is the mastoid and stylite processes. Superiorly is the inferior surface of the greater wing of the sphenoid. And inferiorly is where the medial pterygoid attaches to the mandible near its angle. I won't ask questions on that. And that's a promise because I don't ask them. I'm just trying to get you to understand. Temporal fossas here. Infratemporal fossas right here. Now, they have removed the zygomatic process of the temporal bone and part of the temporal process of the zygomatic bone so we can see inside. Here is the, where are we here? Here's your ear hole, if you want to call that. Your internal auditory meatus here, so you're getting a sense of where we are. The reason this is here is just to let you know that when I'm teaching you a muscle, I say, you know, find the attachment on the blah, blah, blah of the infratemporal fossa. You have a better understanding of it, okay? So we have to remember, this you do need to know, here are our movements, depression, elevation, protrusion, retrusion, and side to side. These are all the muscles that are responsible for this. So you might want to take this slide and use it for your study purposes because we are going to take each of these muscles individually, and this just might be a way to lay out for yourself to remind yourself, you know, which action each of the muscles does. And I do get into them a little bit more with understanding when we're talking about them, okay? All right. So, you have learned your bones. You have learned your joints. So, the first muscles we're going to do are the muscles of facial expression. So we think about our, you know, being able to raise our eyebrows and smile and do all those sorts of things. Yeah. We'll get there. We're going to talk about it a whole lot. We're not down. So again, the other thing I'm doing is I'm actually, because we're doing the axial skeleton, starting at the top, and we're slowly going to work our way down. So when we're talking about the cervical spine, we'll get into the higher bone. Okay? All right. So all of these things that we can do with our faces are muscles that we are within our face, and we have, from an evolutionary point of view, we utilize expression, and we interpret it as certain things as human beings. So, you know, we've learned, you know, we know if someone's, I actually do this, and I used to do this in one of my classes, is it's quite fascinating. I'll take pictures of facial expressions and have you by yourself just write what you think that picture is, and then you share it in the crowd, and the diversity of interpretation of expression is wholly and completely based on your own life experiences, right? So there's differences, and that's part of the problem with expression, because we sometimes misinterpret it, right? You'll say to someone, "You look really mad." "I'm not mad. What are you talking about?" Right? Right? Or you look at someone and go, "Well, he looks like a complete jerk." Why? Because he might look like somebody that you knew in the past, maybe thin lips or the way his eyes are or something, right? So it's all based on interpretation. So muscles of facial expression lie in the subcutaneous tissue and are attached to the skin of the face, not to bone. All the muscles in your face attach to fascia and skin only. If I needed to do an operation, let's say you fractured your orbit bone, the surgeon will take their scalpel and cut you from ear to ear and peel your face off. And then they go at the bone, because those muscles of your face, they don't attach to the bone, right? You don't want to go through skin to repair an orbit bone, because then you have scarring in the face, those sorts of things. But you literally can cut someone from ear to ear and pull the entire face down. Yeah, and then they just pull it back. That's all they do. Yeah, so they make a cut and pull the skin back. No, the nerves lie within that subcutaneous tissue too. Yeah. Yeah, but that's a totally different tissue. You can, I mean, the side effect or potential for that facial surgery or that repair of the orbit bone does carry a risk of facial nerve damage, which could result in lack of feeling, paresthesia or anesthesia. But ultimately, all that runs through the fascia of the face. You literally can peel a face back and put it back on. And still be fine. Wasn't there a lady, quite a number of years ago, had a facial transplant? She was terribly disfigured from sapphire or something. Yeah, and they took a face from one person who was in an accident, and they put that face on her, and it worked just fine. Oh, yeah. So because these muscles lie within the fascia of the face is the reason why we can do all the things with our face that we can. So in other words, they produce effects by affecting the skin, not the facial skeleton. Now, what's nice about the facial nerves, they're all innervated by the same nerve. So you don't have to say one's innervated by this nerve and one's innervated by that nerve. All the muscles of facial expression are innervated by cranial nerve 12. Remember I told you, whenever you see Roman numerals, that's a cranial nerve, which means that the nerves come out of the head to affect. I said 7, didn't I? Oh, sorry. Sorry, it is 7. Yes. Sorry, I said 12. I guess I thought it was an X. I apologize. So cranial nerve 7, and that means that the nerve comes out of those apertures, in some cases, in the front of the face, right? You know, you think of the mental protuberant, the mental foramen, the infraorbital foramen, and so forth. These are holes where you also have another one up here where the facial nerve comes by the temporal bone, which we didn't get into. You will in your neuro class. These muscles also surround the orifices and act as sphincters and dilators. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, this is a sphincter, the same as what you're all thinking about when I say sphincter, but this is a sphincter. Because the face has no distinct deep fascia, and the superficial fascia is between the cutaneous attachments, skin, cutaneous attachments of the facial muscles, which is loose, this is why when your face is cut, the wound looks always worse than it is. It opens right up because of the fact that you've done damage to the fascia as well as the muscle, so they gape. Facial wounds gape and look far worse than they really are. Yeah, you get a lot. There's a lot of blood supply in the face as well, right? That's why, you know, if you watch any boxing or MMA, that kind of stuff, a well-directed punch on some individuals have, I guess, very thick skin, and they'll take a beating and nothing ever happens. And other fighters barely get hit, and things wide open, there's blood everywhere, and those, so it has to do with thickness of skin. So we can see here, when I talk about the facial nerve and the innervation to these muscles of the face, this is a cadaver. The skin has been retracted, and you can see the significance of the nervous innervation to facial muscles. Now, imagine if you have to do facial surgery, right? You've got to be very careful. I mean, you can do some of these lesser branches, and they'll kind of grow back to some degree, but you can see here, here's the facial nerve where it's exiting it out, just inferior anterior to the external auditory meatus, and then branches out and serves all the muscles that are within the skin of the face. The skin has been somewhat removed here, the superficial surface, and so you can see in this specimen, the skin is still on the ears, it's still on the nose, but all the other rest of the skin has been removed. And you can see all the muscles that are underlying that superficial part of the skin. Okay, here's our first muscle, ladies and gentlemen. Here we go. Occipital frontalis. Okay, so this muscle lies over the occipital and frontal bones. So here and here. All right? They are connected by a sheet of connective tissue called the epicranial aponeurosis. So you have muscle tissue here, and tendinous tissue between the two running over the vertex. Okay? It has an anterior belly, frontalis, again named after the bone it's lying in front of, and a posterior part called occipitalis, which of course lies over top of the occipital bone. The posterior attachment is attached to bone, whereas the anterior attachment is to soft tissue. So just as a reminder, I said, these muscles on the face, they don't attach to bone. Frontalis is considered a facial muscle, therefore it's within the fascia of the face. Whereas occipitalis, because it's posterior to the face, finds a direct bony attachment in the occipital area. Okay? So, therefore, the muscle moves from the anterior attachment to the posterior attachment, which results in, pull those eyebrows up, because it's locking in, it's fixed posteriorly, and as it reaches through that epicranial aponeurosis to the frontal bone, it pulls it up. Okay? Oh, yeah. They have their own muscles. No, they stay in. Your eyes don't come out. So your eyelids sit anterior to your eyeballs. So if I pulled the face down properly enough, you would see the eyeballs lying in the sockets with the fat and the muscles around them, and they could still roll around and do whatever they were doing. They just wouldn't have any eyelids over them. So I was just talking about this. So as you all know, I worked in the slaughterhouse, right? I told you guys I worked in the slaughterhouse for a couple of years. So one of the jobs I had to do is I had to remove the cheek meat off the cow. Now, in those days, it was just considered something you throw and grind it for hamburger. But if anybody here is kind of into cooking, cheeks are very schmoozy now. Everybody wants to do cheek meat. I make cheek meat tacos, and it's just like butter. If you cook them right, they just melt. Anyways, so because I had to remove it, when the cow's head came to the area where I had to do that, all the skin was off the cow's head, right? And the eyeballs were still completely intact, and because the nerves were still somewhat alive and not quite fully dead, the eyes would roll around in the skull while it was kind of sitting there, right? Yeah. So therefore, the muscles of the eye were still holding the eyeball in place, but the face had been removed of the cow. You could see all the bones except for the cheeks, which were still intact, and that's why it would be the same with us. If I remove this face down by the eyes, the eyelids would come with it, but your eyes would stay. Oh, yeah, it was spooky. the eyes would stay completely intact because they're being held in place by those muscles that relate to the eyeball themselves. Okay? So you can see here, here's occipitalis here in the occipital area. Here's frontalis here. And this whole fascial sheet that runs over the top of the head is the epicranial aponeurosis. Here is frontalis here as it relates, hence the reason why when occipitalis is fixated, you're able to lift your eyebrows up because it's pulling on that epicranial aponeurosis from the back and over the top, and it pulls that forehead up. Okay? So occipitalis attaches on the lateral two-thirds of the highest nuchal line of the occipital bone and the mastoid area of the temporal bone. So I'm going to, seeing it's your first muscle, I'm just going to take a breath for a moment, close your eyes, and think of where that is. Because this is the way it's going to be taught, right? So you have to be able to remember your bony anatomy as it relates to attachments. When I say the lateral two-thirds of the highest nuchal line, where was that? What was that coming off of? What was the anatomical structure that the nuchal lines laterally come off of? The external occipital protuberance, right. And I'm saying the lateral two-thirds. So we have to think of where that line comes out, and it's the lateral two-thirds. Okay? Everybody follow? Okay, good. And the mastoid area. So now you have to come across that lateral two-thirds of the nuchal line. You have to come all the way to that mastoid process, which is just behind the ear in that area. Right, so you get a sense of the coverage, right? And of course, occipitalis goes to the epicranial aponeurosis. So occipitalis runs from the bony attachment posterior head to the epicranial attachment, whereas frontalis arises from the epicranial aponeurosis and goes to the fascia and skin overlying the frontal bone in this area here. Occipitalis goes from here to here. Frontal goes from here to here. Functions. It draws the scalp posteriorly, which is the elevation of the eyebrows, and it can draw the scalp anteriorly. That some people can do, you know, that wrinkly thing. You know, kind of when you go, huh? Right? Okay. Innervation, of course, is cranial nerve 7. So we can see here its actions here. It can cause the wrinkles here above the eyes, raise the eyebrows, do the Elvis. I can't do an Elvis. I can't do one side than the other. Yeah, it's hard. I can do both, but I can't do one and then the other. Okay. Here's the other thing when I do muscles that you must remember. If I give you a trigger point referral pattern, you must remember this, and I do ask questions on it. I might actually put the picture up and say, what muscle is this? Or I may write and say, you can see here, occipital belly produce headache pain in the back of the head and behind the eye. So in other words, when I'm doing the referral patterns, we can say that when we're in occipitalis, which is here, the patient may actually say, I have significant pain behind my eye, deep behind my eye. Classic trigger point for occipitalis, okay? They can feel discomfort when pressing the back of the head on a pillow or back of the chair, so they may feel some discomfort there. Now, when you have a trigger point in frontalis, it tends to produce headaches in the forehead and occasionally can cause tingling and prickling pain in said same area, okay? And it would be unilateral. So the right frontalis would express pain over the right eye. The left frontalis would experience this kind of pain over the left eye. Okay? Oh, yeah. Yeah, people have that are wrinkly all the time can really have them. What's that? Sometimes, yeah, very, very small and referral pattern, yes. Okay. All right. That was occipital frontalis. The next one is called orbicularis oculi. What does oculi suggest to you? The eye, and orbicularis means, right, orbital, right. So this muscle is a sphincter, okay? So it runs from the medial side of the eye to the medial side of the eye. Yeah, so it starts here and attaches here, okay? And you can see it here. Here's one of your, there's some minor attachments around, but you can see here it starts medially and comes around to medially, okay? Palpebra, yep. So now as it circles, if it wasn't attached a little bit more, it would, you know, kind of fall off. So you have the medial to medial attachment. As the muscle encircles the eye, it attaches at a number of places. There is a nasal part of the frontal bone and the frontal process of the maxilla and the medial palpebral ligament. So we can see here is the medial palpebral ligament here, coming just, you know, sort of that, just at the, off the nasal bones, right at where the eyes come together. And you can see you've got a bit of this attachment here on the frontal bone, helping to anchor the muscle a bit more. It also runs through the connective tissue of the eyelids themselves. So, you know, this muscle is within the eyelids as well. And you've got the connective tissue there. And then it does find attachment on the lacrimal bone. If you remember where that was, remember it was one of the smallest bones, kind of deep, kind of in a little bit more almost into the orbits, right? Yeah. Yep. You can actually palpate it. If you go just medial to the lacrimal gland there, you can feel a bit of a soft tissue ligament right there. Yep. Functions, it closes and squints the eyes, which is its primary action. So I'm always going to say that as well, which is the primary action. If it doesn't say primary, it still happens, but it's to a lesser degree. It depresses the upper eyelid and elevates the lower eyelid. Does that make sense? All right? It's got to bring the upper one down, bring the lower one up. Retraction of the lower eyelid and assists in tear transport and drainage. Right? So when we're blinking all the time, what we're in fact doing is moving tears around the eyeball itself. Of course, facial nerve, cranial nerve 7, and we can see it here. There are other parts, but they're not of our concern. But we can see here where they're. Circles the eye, and it is, because it's circular, it is considered to be a sphincter. Yeah. Define relaxed. Like dead, for example. Yes. If you're dead, your eyes don't close when you die. Your eyes are, they relax and they semi-close, but they don't fully close. What's that? Not in my experience. It's close, but it's not quite. Like it tends to get, because the muscles relax a bit, but they don't tend to fully close. Not like in the movies where they go, right? Okay. Next, nasalis. Oh, yes. Yes. Yep. Well, no, I don't think both opening and closing, because it does both. I think you're actively doing it either or. Like you're actively either open or you're actively closed, depending on what you're after, right? Because it does both. It does open and it does close. So it's a good question with sleep. I'm not particularly sure. Well, but you still need muscle contraction to close them. Because anybody here heard of, there's a name for it. It's facial nerve palsy. You know? Bell's palsy. Thank you. People with Bell's palsy actually have to have their eyelids taped because the eye will stay open. So, yeah, with its paralysis of the facial muscle, right? So the eyes will stay open, so they'll tape it close. Otherwise, the eye will dry out and you'll lose your eye. What's that? Yeah, it only affects half the face, but it can leave residual problems. Does everybody remember Jean Chrétien? So Jean Chrétien had that mouth because he had Bell's palsy, and he was left with a bit of paralysis still on the side of his lip. So it happens. Okay, next, nasalis. It arises from the maxilla, remember, in this area here, to the cartilages of the nose and the opposite side nasalis muscle. This is where you can flare your nostrils, if you can flare your nostrils. They always say that in the books, right? He was so mad his nostrils flared. I'm like, okay, sure. Oh, I don't know. My dad used to flare pretty good. But it also, and I can't do it well. It can close them. Can you? Yeah. Not sure. Okay, you can see it. Here's nasalis. Here, a very small muscle kind of over the top. Now you can see these last couple of muscles. I don't have trigger points for them because they're not common, so you don't have to know them. Only if I put the trigger points on the slide are the ones that you need to know. Okay? Zygomaticus major. So that tells you it's a larger muscle and it's related to the zygomatic bone. So it attaches from the zygomatic bone near the zygomaticotemporal suture. So you should all know where that is now. Right? Remember how the zygomatic process of the temporal bone articulates with the temporal process of the zygomatic bone to form the zygomatic arch. So we're saying that it arises from the zygomatic bone near that zygomaticotemporal suture, where the temporal bone and the zygomatic bone meet. And it runs to the angle of the mouth. So running this way. So therefore, this is the primary muscle of smile. Right? This muscle has to, so you can always tell when someone's faking a smile because you're going across, you're not going up. So when you really smile, that's when this muscle comes in, is it pulls those lateral aspects of the mouth up. Maybe they're not really smiling. And it can laterally draw the angle back a little bit. Like it's like a zygomaticus major. Is that what you're saying? Yes. So here it is right here. Coming down to that angle. There is a minor. We're not going to worry about the minor. I just kind of throw this in here because it is kind of the smile muscle that we use. Yes. That's buccinator. I was tomato. No, it's a good point because it's tomato, tomato. And so when I learned it, when I went to school, my teacher called it buccinator. If you talk to someone in dental, they'll call it buccal or buccal, right? That's a term used in dental, right? It's like I had an English teacher or an English anatomy teacher. It wasn't the duodenum, it was the duodenum. But you were taught duodenum, weren't you? Yes. Right. And here we go. Yes. It's up here in the nose. Yeah. Nah, a little bit, but the major one is this one, zygomaticus major. Okay, so we've got buccinator, whatever. So it arises from the maxilla and the mandible at the external surfaces of the alveolar processes of the molars. So think of where those are. So the alveolar processes is where the roots of the teeth go into the bone. So we're talking back here, right? So maxilla and mandible. So maxilla and mandible near that area of the alveolar processes of the molar. So significantly kind of back here, right? To the lips, just lateral to the angle of the mouth. If we look at it, it's basically your cheek muscle, okay? Fills in that whole cheek, right? So what does it do? It compresses the cheek against the teeth when we're masticating. What's masticating? Right. So when we're chewing food, this muscle keeps the food, and occasionally, unfortunately, it gets a bit uncoordinated, and it's not where it's supposed to be, and you bite down to chew food, and you take a chunk right out of it, right? Okay, that does occasionally happen. All right, orbicularis oris. So orbicularis oculi was the eye. Orbicularis oris is the sphincter, which is your mouth. It's your mouth. So it completely surrounds the mouth. It has four parts, two on the upper left, upper and lower, and two on the right, upper and lower. The fibers attachments traverse through the tissue of the upper or the lower lip. So this muscle, it surrounds the mouth, but also travels through the lips itself. It closes the mouth and it protracts the lip when we, it's your kissing muscle. When your grandmother's kissing you, right? Right, okay? Or, yeah, now it's the selfie muscle. Right, I don't get that, I just don't get that. So you can see two sides coming together in the middle, okay? And again, can pucker the lips and also closes the mouth as well. Okay, so that's mastication or facial. Next, we have muscles of mastication. And amongst other actions as well, okay? So, let's do the mastication muscles first. So these are muscles that are going to involve fundamentally the relationship between the mandible and the maxilla at the temporal mandibular joint, right? These are muscles that are going to cause us to open and close when we're chewing, okay? So, you can see here we have quite a number of them. And again, some of them that are here are not related to facial muscles. So we have sternocleidomastoid here, which has more of a relationship to the C-spine. We have our scalenes here and so forth. So some of these muscles down here is not really what we're talking about, not for this lecture, but we are talking about in this area here. So our first is called temporalis. I sort of alluded to it last week when I was talking about the infratemporal line. And of course, you guys had it in the question. So its attachments, the entire temporal fossa, except the portion on the zygomatic bone. And it goes to the coronoid process and the ramus of the mandible. Now, I always taught and still teach it that it's the inferior temporal line, but it does cover the fossa as well. So we can see here that it covers this whole area here, but it does attach to that infratemporal fossa as well. I don't put it in here because your book, Muscolino, doesn't put it in there. I'm not particularly sure why, but it's always been that way. I'm getting a little upset with some of these authors. It's like that median line instead of sagittal and stuff like that. I don't know where these folks are coming up with all this stuff. It's weird. So the entire temporal fossa except the portion of the zygomatic bone, and it goes to the coronoid process, which is where? Here, right? And the ramus of the mandible, which is the vertical part. Okay, so it attaches on here to here. The anterior border, apex, posterior border, and internal surface of the coronoid process. Anterior border, apex, posterior border, and internal surface of the coronoid process, as well as the anterior border of the mandible. So it attaches here, 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 and here. Okay? Here, 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 and here. It functions, its primary action is elevation, which therefore is muscle that closes the mouth. It's a closer, so it's an elevator, so it closes the mouth. It retracts the mandible at the TMJ. So retraction means when both are working bilaterally, meaning when the right and left are both contracting, it pulls the mandible into retraction, all right? The anterior fibers elevate the mandible. Now, we have to start getting a little picky here. We have to understand, we have to go back to that relationship I talked about, is when we look at a joint and we look at its axis of movement and we think of a muscle as stupid, and we have to remember a muscle just contracts. Its fibers or its relationship to the axis is what causes the action that it does. So right now, at this point, you've learned the entire muscle does X, Y, or Z, correct? Now it gets a little pickier because we can then look at where fibers are in a very large muscle in relationship to the axis of movement, okay? So we say the anterior fibers elevate the mandible. So if we look at the direction of the fibers here in the relationship to the coronoid process of the temporomandibular joint, can you see how that's an elevator because the fibers are so vertical? Yes, does that make sense? Right? So they're so vertical, they're an elevator. The posterior fibers retract. Does that make sense when you look at the fiber direction here? Right? You can see how the fiber direction would cause retraction, right? Okay? And many muscles are like that, that certain fibers have slightly different responsibilities when looking at them. And believe it or not, the nervous system, the brain, can recruit the area that it wants at times. So it can actually, through the message that goes to the muscle from the brain, it can only have certain fibers to control. Okay? So for example, gluteus medius, okay, altogether is an abductor. Posterior fibers abduct and extend, anterior fibers abduct and do slight flexion. And that's really important if I'm doing a remedial exercise routine that I want to isolate one versus another. And it may muscle test the patient because they've got pain. I'll test the whole muscle, then the posterior fibers and the anterior fibers, and maybe the anterior fibers like there's nothing there. And I'm speaking from experience. As a runner, I had this huge problem a few years ago. I couldn't even run anymore. I went to a sports medicine guy, and he's like, yeah, your posterior fibers aren't even firing anymore. So I had to do all these exercises for about 6 months, strengthen those posterior fibers of glute med, and I could go back to running again. Yeah. So anterior fibers elevate. You saw that. Posterior fibers retract. And then the middle fibers do both. We are much more powerful in elevation than we are in depression. Just like alligators and crocodiles. Right? So they always say, you know, you never want to get your hand in a crocodile's mouth when they're closing. You're doomed. But if you can get the crocodile with his or her mouth closed and hold that mouth closed, they can't open it. They're not strong enough to open it. Right? It's just, we're kind of the same. Okay? Everybody understand that? So here we are. We've got, you know, the coronoid process here, anterior, bit of posterior top, and then all the way down the mandible here, which this doesn't show very well. But Muscolino does. So this is out of your textbook that you've been using in lab. You can see it here. It covers the whole area. The tendon comes all the way down into the ramus as well. Okay? All right. So innervation. Now we're no longer in facial muscles that everybody has the same nerve, cranial nerve 7. This muscle is innervated by the trigeminal nerve, cranial nerve 5, via the deep temporal branch. And yes, that's how picky this course is going to get. This is, in my estimation, charting. Making charts, laying it all out. Now, for me, I think I told you guys before, with my apartment in the mirror and I drew all this stuff. So as I went through every muscle, I might have a picture of a head, and I'd do each muscle in its place on that head. So I'd have a piece of paper, you know, running all, and then below would be attachments, actions, innervation. Okay? Now, as part of what we were talking about with TMJ issues and kind of pulling that mandible down, this is the stretch for it. So sometimes I'll also have stretches out of your Muscolino. And of course, you'll need to know these as well as part of your remedial exercise. So just literally just pulling and depressing the jaw will do it. If you want a sense of how strong your temporalis is, just put your fingertips in the temporalis area and clench your teeth. You'll feel it pop right out, right? That's temporalis. Sorry? What's that? Yeah, I don't know. Well, that patarian is considered to be a bit of a sensitive area where all the four bones come together. So a well-placed impact there can cause some issues. What's that? Yeah, you can shove that sphenoid bone around a little bit. Right. A baseball bat works well, too. always makes me laugh in the movies. Somebody takes a baseball bat or a crowbar to the head, and the next scene they're up and walking around. It's like, yeah, great. Okay, trigger points. This muscle definitely has a trigger point pattern that we need to know, because again, if you're a clencher or a grinder, you can imagine how much this muscle is getting used. So overuse of the muscle can result in trigger points, and that can be nocturnal grinding or clenching, excessive gum chewing, occlusal symmetry, which means your teeth don't line up very well, protracted head posture. So anterior head carriage, which we kind of did there as a demonstration last week, that's bad for TMJ too. If you have a TMJ problem, I never want to see you chewing gum. That is number one. Do not chew gum if you have a TMJ issue, because you're overworking your muscles, and all you're going to do is make those muscles worse. No, the problem is with TMJ, they're too strong. That's the problem. So sometimes people have temporal mandibular joint problems simply because they're one of those individuals who chew gum all day, every day, all the time. What's that? No, I'm stretching them. Like leaving your tongue on the roof of your mouth and opening your mouth? So, for those who have TMJ problems, first and foremost, right now, all you guys with TMJ problems, have your tongue up on the roof of your mouth. You all have your tongue pushed straight up against the roof of your mouth, don't you? Okay, so here's what I'd like you to do. I want you to melt your tongue into the floor of your mouth, and that includes the back part, too. Yes, you can. With practice, you can. Try to get that whole tongue to melt down into that bottom of the mouth, and you'll feel your whole jaw relax. So, trigger points in this muscle get kind of unusual because they cause pain and hypersensitivity of the upper teeth and adjacent gums. So you might be getting trigger points in temporalis because of grinding and chewing, but you're going to the dentist because you think you have a toothache. That something's going on, like a cavity or something in a tooth may be the reason for it. These trigger points often are incorrectly diagnosed as headaches, dental disease, or TMJ disorder. Okay? So, you know, as I said, many of you may, when you get a headache, you do the temporal rub anyways. So it could be that you've got trigger points in there. I'll do one more and we'll be done. Masseter. So that was temporalis. It's a closer. Masseter has a superficial layer and a deep layer. So here's your deep head here in behind. Here's your superficial head. You can see it here as well. This is the deep head. This is the superficial head. The superficial head arises from the inferior margins of the zygomatic bone and the zygomatic arch. In other words, if we follow that zygomatic arch around, this muscle lies right along the inferior border of that zygomatic arch, okay, the superficial head. And it goes to the angle and inferior half of the external surface of the ramus of the mandible. So again, stick your fingers here at the angle of your mandible while your mouth is relaxed, kind of just push in ever so gently, and clench. It really pops out, doesn't it? That's masseter, okay? That's masseter. Now, some of you, if you get in here right at the angle and push a bit firmly, you might find it's pretty uncomfortable. Yeah. Again, this muscle goes with TMJ issue. Yep. I wouldn't go quite that aggressive. I would go straight in the muscle. Yeah. You can do it, but it's pretty aggressive. Now, the deep layer, it too is in the inferior margin and deep surface of the zygomatic arch. This is the inferior margins, and this is a bit deeper in. And it goes, to the external surface of the coronoid process, superior one half, the external surface of the ramus of the mandible. So the superficial layer kind of gets all the way down to the angle, and the deeper layer, the deeper layer kind of just comes down onto the ramus itself. Its primary function is elevation, closing. It's a closer. It protracts the mandible at the TMJ, and it can also retract the mandible at the TMJ. So we can see here, the superficial head will tend to protract. You can see a bit of that anterior to posterior angle here of the superficial head. And then the deep head's more posterior to anterior, so therefore it's a retractor. Okay? Its innervation is the trigeminal nerve 5, the anterior trunk. The stretch is exactly the same as temporalis, because temporalis was an elevator, so of course masseter is an elevator as well. Again, a muscle for trigger points for sure. Again, chewing gum too much, occlusal asymmetry, your teeth aren't lining up properly, protracted head. Like, there is a huge amount of research that this poor posture of anterior head carriage, right? So here, so sit up with the posture I gave you last week. Okay, all right. Now, try to open your mouth as wide as you can. Get a sense of how wide that is. Relax. Now, put yourself into really shitty posture at your head carriage. Now, try to open your jaw. See the difference? You can't open it as much, can you? Right? Okay, so believe it or not, that poor posture of anterior head carriage promotes TMJ problems too. Yeah. You're going to say men too, aren't you? Yes. Trigger points tend to produce restricted depression of the mandible, pain and hypersensitivity of the upper lower molars as well. But here's what's interesting. This can cause tinnitus. Trigger points in this muscle can cause ringing in the ears. It is another reason why when TMJ issues first came out, there were books out there and everything. So people got cavities in their teeth for no reason at all. People would go to their physicians because they had ringing in the ears and they couldn't figure out why. And it was a trigger point. They were trigger points. So you can get ringing in the ears from a trigger point from this muscle. Okay? See ya. Yeah. No, go and get treated is the key point. No, I can't treat anymore. I'm not licensed anymore. I have an inactive license. I can't because I've got pretty significant issues with my thumb. I can't treat anymore. What's that? Yeah, I can barely even bring my thumb to my little finger anymore. I can't squeeze a tube of toothpaste. Yeah. But 26 years of massaging.